Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Monroe Carman. I am president of the club and editor-at-large at Bloomberg Business News. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience, as well as those of you listening to this program on National Public Radio or watching it on C-SPAN or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind members of our next speaker. Tomorrow, Friday, December 15th, John Sweeney, the new president of the AFL-CIO, will talk about his agenda for American workers. Transcripts and audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers. The book contains 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. And again, to order a copy of the book, you call 1-800-211-4020. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table. Pass them up to me, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests. Ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Adam Levy, Bloomberg Business News. Diana Gregg, Bureau of National Affairs. Christina Del Valle, Business Week. Michael Remez, Hartford Current. Howard Baker, former Senate Majority Leader. Former White House Chief of Staff. He's former a lot of things. But now he's a member of the Board of Directors of United Technologies. Skipping over our speaker for the moment, Doug, here you are. Doug Harbreck, Business Week and member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee who arranged today's luncheon. Carol Stevens of the Detroit News. Nancy Dunn of the Financial Times. Paul Mann, Aviation Week. Stephanie Wood, producer-reporter for the Nightly Business Report, and Tim Smart of Business Week. Our guest today is one energetic guy, believe me. His idea of relaxation is to race ocean-going sailboats in his spare time. But George David doesn't relax much these days. The chief executive officer of United Technologies is too busy traveling the globe to explore emerging markets in China, Russia, Vietnam, and elsewhere. His mission is to spread the word about his company's products. Many of them are familiar to you: Carrier air conditioners, Otis elevators, Sikorsky helicopters. David began his rise to the top of United Technologies by pressing the up button at Otis Elevators. Thank you. That was my only laugh line. I worked very hard on that. And I think I missed a beat in the timing, but I really appreciate that. After running its Latin American operations, Mr. David returned home to take over the U.S. unit and become chief executive in 1986. 8 years later, Mr. David assumed the top job at United Technologies. He is engaged in a wholesale makeover of the $22 billion company, once known primarily as a supplier of hardware to the Pentagon. David's game plan is to turn the United Technologies focus away from the U.S. and toward markets in Asia and Latin America. He believes in getting into emerging markets early and aggressively, whether it was China following Tiananmen Square or Russia after Gorbachev. United Technologies has been in the vanguard of those American corporations willing to take chances on risky foreign ventures. The strategy, however, has embroiled Mr. David and his company in controversy. Back home in Connecticut, they are frequently accused of shipping valuable American manufacturing jobs to low-wage countries abroad. Over the past 5 years, United Technologies has eliminated one-third of its jobs in the United States. Mr. David makes no apologies for this. The 53-year-old Harvard graduate with an MBA from the University of Virginia believes the world's center of economic gravity is shifting to the east, and he wants to make sure United Technologies moves with it. In Mr. David's view, the restructuring of corporate America that has been going on to improve its competitiveness is permanent and is making new demands on employees. Today, he'll discuss those demands and will outline his thoughts on what to do to help workers cope with the new reality. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. George David.
Thank you, Monroe, for those nice comments. Thank you especially also for the nice promotional plugs for Otis, Carrier, and Sikorsky. And if I might, I might just add commercial plug for Pratt and Whitney aircraft engines, which we also build. My topic this afternoon is the economic transformation in our nation and world so dramatically affecting us all. Millions of jobs lost, significant and sustained widening in distributions of incomes among Americans and distributions of wealth, the losses of senses of permanency and predictability in our lives, and consequently, a big increase in the stridency in political rhetoric that we see in the news every single day. I have some views about what causes our situation today. I have some opinions about what not to do about it. And I have some suggestions also on what to do about it. The challenge before us is education, and specifically, dramatically increased investments in mid-career education for a large percentage of the 120 million or so Americans who presently work full-time. And I am not speaking here about the usual on-the-job training or even the employee outplacement assistance programs offered by all of us in corporate America. Instead, I mean the wholesale elevation of the American workforce to a society that creates rather than makes things and that manages networks of organizations staffed by others who make things. Now, these transformations of job loss and change, increased globalization and competition, higher technology content, and above all, opened information flows among nations and institutions are truly reshaping the world in which we live. Today, a full 80% of the wealth of the world belongs to the 15% of the world's population so fortunate as to live in Europe, Japan, and the United States. This leaves 4.8 billion people outside advanced economies with their attendant benefits of education, healthcare, leisure, and retirement income security. But now, do not expect me for even a minute today to launch onto a foreign aid theme. This speech today is flatly about America's self-interest. The truth of the next three decades is that more, and I believe much, much more, of the world's population is going to enter advanced economic status. It will go from the 15% today I mentioned a moment ago to a likely 40% of the planet's population by the year 2025, and that's more than an additional 2.5 billion people. And even if we set China aside as a special situation, the total is still more than a billion newly advantaged and newly productive people. This is also a very markedly different situation than the last 50 years. Everyone talks about globalization today, but the fact remains that only one nation, only one in the entire post-war period, has truly crossed the threshold from a pre-capitalist to an economically and technically advanced society, and that nation is, of course, Japan. In contrast, the next three decades are going to see, I believe, 20 times that number of people cross that threshold. And that, I represent, really is globalization. And it's in front of us, for sure, not behind us. Now, some hold the view that globalization will bring pauperization. And that is the notion that others in the world will get rich on our backs, that there will always be some qualified person somewhere in the world willing to do the same job for less, thereby depressing our own incomes, and that the solutions, therefore, have to be Fortress America, Fortress Europe, fortresses that keep the wealth in and the poverty out. Nothing, in my view, could be further from the truth. And understanding that there might even be an alternative viewpoint or two today in the audience, I recognize my burden to be persuasive. Let's look at the downsides of these transformations I mentioned first. And I'll be specific. Since 1990, our company alone, as Monroe indicated in the introduction, has eliminated 33,000 jobs in the United States, about one job in three. During that same time, we have added 15,000 jobs outside the United States. We have no reason to believe that this trend for corporate America will change soon. And in fact, if anything, it will accelerate. And as this data might seem at the outset to play clearly to the Fortress America theme, I ask you to please be patient. More broadly, and according to our government, some 9 million Americans lost their jobs between 1991 and 1993. In 1994, amidst the strongest domestic economy we have had in a decade, our largest manufacturing companies still laid off about 500,000 employees. And that was two-thirds again more jobs lost by those companies than in the recession year of 1990. And in most cases, those jobs are gone forever. And again, this may seem like Fortress America is the answer. So again, I ask you to please be patient. We know that the lost jobs were replaced in the aggregate because employment nationwide did, in fact, go up. But we also know the problem with replacement jobs, which is that they all too often trade down materially in skill and in wage content, in job security, and in continuity. I received a letter from a former employee a few months ago that highlights this indeed very, very tough situation. The writer, a 49-year-old employee, former employee, with three children, no college education, and with many, many years of service with our company, said that being laid off can only be compared to losing a body limb. This employee had had three job offers since job loss, and all of them were at starting wages in the $6 to $8 per hour range. Now, there is job creation in our country, but the new jobs are, generally speaking, no rivals to the old jobs. Over the next decade, the leading job increase categories in America, and again, this is according to our government, will be retail salespeople, cashiers, nursing aides, and orderlies. We will hire more security guards in the next 10 years than elementary school teachers in America. We will add 200,000 new lawyers and judges, and we will add another 200,000 corrections officers to sustain an ever higher prison population. Now, there is not anything wrong with creating these kinds of jobs per se. What is alarming is that these are the primary job categories that we are creating as our diversified economy and society begins to look more like one built around the three institutions of hospital, prison, and shopping mall. And these are not the jobs that build international competitiveness, that create wealth, and that leave the promise of a better world for our children. Monroe said that I travel a lot, and he's right. I've been going across the globe for three solid decades, steadily and pretty intensively, and they bring me close to the source of the problem, which is that the American economy is losing and will continue to lose dominion over world markets. All over the world, people want the investments in technologies to manufacture their own products, and very often they can, and not even rarely that can they do that at world-class levels. But what is also equally clear is that American ideas and ideals are not losing leadership in our world at all, and they will not, especially if we practice intelligent, involved economic globalism. One of our subsidiaries, which is the Otis Elevator Company, that was the button that went up, demonstrates very well this approach. Otis has impeccable lineage, founded in Yonkers, New York in 1853, by Mr. Elisha Graves Otis, a real Yankee innovator and pioneer. And as recently as the 1950s, Otis was an export-driven company staffed more than one half by Americans. Today, Otis has 66,000 employees in the world, and fewer than 1 in 10 of these is American. Otis leads the elevator market in the entire world and leads in every region of the world with the single exception of Japan. And even in that toughest market, we have tripled our share of market in the last 20 years. Otis has employees globally in 1,900 cities of this planet. That is, just for reference, twice as many as American Express, which we typically as Americans regard as ubiquitous. It's also 6 times more even than our own United States Department of State. The OTUS is like water, which is to say, everywhere. This shift in OTUS's center of gravity, which has happened, and similar but less dramatic ones in our other UTC companies and in other American companies across our country, is flatly, flatly not in pursuit of lower labor costs and import substitution. I hate that cheap labor argument because it is bogus and it is false. And by the way, lest my comments so far lead you to conclude otherwise, our company is a big exporter. We exported $3.1 billion last year, and we exported $2.3 billion net of imports. And we are in the top 10 companies in the United States on that latter measure of net exports. And our export jobs are great, high-tech, high-wage, high-benefit jobs. And by the way, they're not so likely to be in risk of migration to these low-labor-cost countries. The picture of overseas employment by American companies is very, very different. Instead, we and others like us create jobs overseas fundamentally for market access, to extend our global market leadership, and thereby to make our company stronger and to assure thereby continuing great high-tech employment at home. We have a good-sized presence in China, and that presence makes the point. We employ about 8,000 people in the People's Republic. They're principally or virtually all local nationals. They principally manufacture air conditioning equipment and elevators. We make money in China. We make lots of money in China. Our company globally is a stronger and better competitor, much stronger and much better, and better able to fund investments in research and development, 3/4 of which we do here at home in the United States and will for a very long time into the future, all of that consequent on our investments in China and on employing 8,000 Chinese people. And let's be very clear, we would not do that work in China with 8,000 Americans, or even a small fraction of that number, not in a million years, because elevators and air conditioners for China are going to be built in China, not in the United States. And the choice in front of us is we can be in the market or we can be out of it. But if we want to be in it, we're going to be in it with 8,000 Chinese, with the revenue and profit stream that goes along with that and how that helps to fund our investments at home. So I do reject emphatically this business of chasing cheap labor, and I invite you to reject Fortress America with me. It is completely wrong. No one denies the real pain that Americans feel as we struggle, all of us, to compete in global markets. But turning inward to America brings us only transitional benefits and real losses, real losses long term. Now, there is a contrary argument to what I offered here, and that is protectionism and regulation, which gets bumper stickered down in the extreme to save your job, save our country. We know what that leads to. In fact, let's talk about protected economies for a moment. One good and simple measure of protectionism is foreign content, or we should say lack of foreign content, in any economy. In the advanced economic world, Western Europe, US, this figure is about 40%, and that's the summation of the production value of foreign investment plus foreign trade. But in the former Soviet Union, to name one, the percentage was zero for decades and is still less than 1% today. That is a closed economy. And there are comparable experiences in the traditionally more closed economies all over the world, in India, in the Latin American economies, and for entirely different reasons, in South Africa. Long the leading overseas investor, our nation is now the leading host country for investments by others in us. The flows come back to us having gone out in years before. Our trade content has also increased dramatically over the past decade, with imports measured in constant dollars having more than doubled to about $650 billion a year, about 12% of our domestic economy. And our export jobs in America, as they are for UTC, are about as high-tech as employment as are found anywhere in the country. Now, the world is globalizing whether we like it or not, and we should like it. I represent we should like it because we are positioned as America alone and best of all to be big winners if only we embrace these forces and shape them to benefit both others and ourselves. But we must alter the character of our corporations and their employees as this transformation occurs. We must change ourselves again from entities that make things to entities that create things, and from organizations that make things to organizations that manage others who make things. We will move to knowledge work and to managerial work and away from actual physical production. And what must concern us today is that we are not preparing ourselves rapidly or effectively for this transition. While our research and development in America, both public and private, have been the dominant economic force globally, the single dominant one in the entire post-war period, we are today reducing our expenditures on R&D in America, measured in constant dollars. And we have not even begun to deal with most of the American workforce, the upgrading of whose skills is the precondition to the newly productive America. Everybody talks about fixing public and higher education, and that is certainly, for sure, a necessary task, but it is by no means the only solution to the situation in which we find ourselves. Even if we had perfect schooling across America, the young men and women leaving those educational systems will not hit their peak productivity and influence at work for 20 or more years in the future. And that is well past the time that we can really leverage America's leadership in the world's economic transformation. I believe the immediate answer is a significant and quick investment in education for the millions of Americans who are already in the workplace. Let's go back to that 49-year-old with job loss after many, many, many years. His loss multiplied by millions is, in fact, devastating for our nation. It's the single worst thing that happens in America today. It is also the result of a behavior that has loaded, for our lifetimes, education into the first 21 years of life, and we then leave the classroom normally, essentially, forever. By some rough estimates, young Americans enrolled in schools and colleges spend about 71 billion man-hours in the classroom each year today. By contrast, employed Americans, that is, after the 21st year, far greater in number spend less than 2 billion hours in traditional undergraduate and graduate education. This pattern no longer works for an economy with the rates of change we experience and where employment may be restructured easily several times during the course of a single career. When we experience restructuring, we need knowledge that is current and not the knowledge that we acquired in the classroom a decade or two or three ago. There are about 120 million Americans at work today. As many as 30 million of these employees will be at risk of job loss, 18 million in administrative or support jobs that are prone to automation, 10 million in manufacturing jobs that are susceptible to foreign competition, and another 2 million in additional white-collar employment that medium and large companies like ourselves, under the extreme pressure of competition, will learn to live without. Now, while no one of us as an individual caused this crisis, it does fall to us as individuals and companies to respond. I have a few suggestions. As a private employer, we cannot guarantee anyone a job, but we are nonetheless obliged, I believe, to provide employees reasonable opportunities to reestablish themselves, ideally on more favorable conditions in the event of job loss. One effort that we have as UTC, and many big public companies like us have the same thing, is tuition and associated expense reimbursement for study toward undergraduate or advanced degrees. It costs us about $11 million a year. The program is open to substantially all of our U.S. employees. We currently have about 4,500 people, or 6% of the eligible population in that group, to take advantage of tuition reimbursement and go on to continuing education. That result is about average for big U.S. corporations, but the very best ones of those, and also the very best divisions inside our own company, have about 20% of employees, or three times more, enrolled in such degree programs. And we might inquire why these percentages are so low. Part may be our fault as employers, and after all, employees have to take the initiative to improve their own situations. What we can do is to work harder to generate program awareness, to provide inducements to participate, to recognize participation, and importantly, to provide time off from work. One inducement is straightforward, and it's also new for us at UTC: earn an undergraduate or an advanced degree in our tuition reimbursement program, and with that degree comes 50 shares of the common stock of the corporation, which was valued this morning, at least when I last heard about it, it was valued at about $4,700. We also share in the time commitments. We all know that time remains the single incompressible constant in our universe, and it is therefore truly life's scarce resource. So we provide now half of classroom time as paid time off from work, which is to say, one half your time, one half our time. In consequence, we hope to see our education participation rate more than triple to 20% over the next 5 years. And I believe that that result is indeed likely to happen. The result will be among the highest for companies of our size and type, and wouldn't that be nice? Other companies will make their own choices about mid-career education, although I do express the opinion that as a group, America's corporations do not do anywhere near as much as we could or should in this area. I refer here especially to mid-career education, which is distinct from the job training efforts we all engage in, and I believe is much more essential to our nation's future. Now, what about our government? First, the president and his senior colleagues can use the bully pulpit. I recall a conversation with Commerce Secretary Brown this last summer when I made the comment, which was not, in fact, entirely in jest, that our goal ought to be a PhD for every single person in America. We need to talk up education as a continuing national priority. More importantly, we should back up that talk with money. Budget negotiators should restore baseline spending on federal student loan programs. The current proposal cuts $5 billion over the next 7 years, and that is wrong. Federal loan programs in our country are the majority of all available student aid. They benefit more than 5 million of our 14 million undergraduate and graduate students in America today. And cuts even of this magnitude, and by the way, larger cuts were envisioned earlier, jeopardize higher education for hundreds of thousands of Americans. Let's also stop taxing as income to employees the tuition reimbursement programs I mentioned earlier. Isn't it bizarre that we do this? We tax tuition reimbursement to an employee on his individual income tax return. The reason why we do it, of course, is the symmetry we normally find in the federal tax code, which is to say, deductible to the employer, taxable to the employee. But if there ever were a case for an exception, this is it. Beyond the societal benefit of education, let us also note that 99% of the people who would benefit from this tax break earn less than $50,000 annually, and a third make less than $20,000 annually. This is, after all, America, and let's reward initiative, not punish it. And what about the tax deductibility of the cost of higher education in total? The idea, of course, has been around for a very, very long time. But we need to keep clearly in front of us that college graduates do earn, on average, 75% more, career average, 75% more than non-graduates. We need to keep clearly in front of us that unemployment among college graduates last year was 3%, while it was 7% among high school graduates. What about the rate of return on these tax deductions? That is to say, the returns when you recapture in later years through higher incomes and higher taxes, the taxes foregone in earlier years through tax deductions. The answer is an easy 15% compound annually. And this is just plain basic finance. And it is persuasive. Look at the possibility another way. We happily subsidize home ownership in our country via interest deductions, and we have since the beginning of income taxation in 1913 in the belief that this promotes a stable and civil society. Why can't we even more reasonably subsidize higher education in the belief that it promotes a better and a more competitive society? We know that even if we do all this, we won't get to that all PhD society I mentioned a moment ago, at least not anytime soon. But we will come, I believe, a lot closer to that fantasy town Lake Wobegon, where everybody can indeed be above average. Initiatives like this are not new to America. The Morrill Act in 1862 created America's network of land-grant colleges by encouraging states to sell public lands and use the proceeds to establish or expand colleges. Ultimately, states sold 17.5 million acres of land, an area greater than the combined states of Rhode Island, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont. 70 of the best schools in the country today are direct beneficiaries of the Morrill Act. 70. They include Cornell, Purdue, Yale, Dartmouth, MIT, Brown, and the state universities of Wisconsin, Minnesota, California, Delaware, Ohio, North Carolina, and Missouri. The GI Bill is more recent and as compelling. Its main benefit to higher education was a $500 annual stipend for returning veterans. Unless that not seem like so much in today's economy, realize that in that year, Harvard's annual tuition was only $600. The results were straightforward and powerful. U.S. college enrollments in 1948 were nearly double pre-war levels, and GI Bill benefits ultimately led to more than 2 million bachelor's degrees for veterans. These remarks today are a call for more higher education, a whole lot more, and targeted specifically at an already older workforce. It is the only defense, and it is the right defense, against the risk of globalization with pauperization. And like any good defense, it is in fact an offense. The challenge is simply to elevate ever larger portions of our population to knowledge work, to the ability to deal in and to work with abstractions. And we will do this with education of the good old garden variety, not OJT on the job training, not self-help books and videos. We do it by teaching people to manipulate ideas and abstractions, which we do in turn with language and literature and math and science. We need structures to accomplish this goal, and I have suggested some. What we also need is will. We need the will of individuals to better themselves and the recognition by themselves that they can. We need the recognition by society and government of the nature and the extent of the challenge. We need the courage to look ahead, the courage to embrace opportunity, and not to defend a past that will not return. America led the rebuilding of Europe and Japan in the post-war period. No doubt about it, we did it. The world's events have again given us the opportunity to lead a mass migration of people into advanced economies. And in the course of our leadership of doing that, to have our institutions and our employees benefit directly and personally from the enormous wealth generation that will occur. The agenda is to educate ourselves in order to enable ourselves to engage with the world with confidence and vision. We have risen to plenty of challenges in America before, and we will rise to this one also. Thank you.
We've got a lot of questions, so let's try to go through some of them. Pretty quickly. How can the U.S. government afford to provide tax incentives for higher education at a time when most other federal programs are being cut because of the budgetary crisis?
Well, we spend about $50 billion a year in America on higher education, and if we made it all tax deductible, and that, of course, would have to be a topic of much discussion and debate, it would be about a $20 billion bill, and that doesn't seem like all so much relative to the size of our federal government, particularly when we put it up against the size of the opportunity that I believe to be in front of us, which I think is truly vast.
All right, just reading over some of these. Why should the U.S. government lead companies into new markets, like Ron Brown's, Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown's, economic missions to China and India? Why can't the corporations do it themselves?
Well, the largest corporations in America do have actually globe-spanning networks of employees and individuals and representations and offices. A whole lot of middle America, in terms of corporate activity, does not have that kind of reach. I'm a big fan of Secretary Brown and of this administration. This administration has done more for business internationally than any administration has in my lifetime. They are terrific and they are great, and they sell products for America, and they sell them in competition with governments of other nations. And it's one of the strongest aspects, in fact, of this administration overseas. People need that kind of help and support, and sometimes we're up against governments, and it's great to see our government right in there with us pitching to sell jobs, to sell work that in many cases leads directly to American employment.
What skills do you believe are most important to the future of work and the workplace in the United States? And what do you think of the recent proposal for a public fund to provide new technology education?
Well, I'm not familiar with the proposal for technology education, although I'd be quick to endorse any kind of a fund like that. The question was, what about specific skills? I guess I'm a big believer that what you need to have to be effective in the world today is basic thinking skills, the ability to think abstractly and in abstract concessions or comprehensions, and above all else, the ability to communicate your conclusions and viewpoints and ideas. So I go back to my comments in the speech, which were language and literature and math and science as the vehicles and devices by which we learn to think abstractly and to communicate the results of our thinking.
How does the U.S. workforce compare to those of other leading countries in one, the educational level attained, two, literacy levels, and three, willingness to work?
Well, there are lots of surveys and studies around, and I can't quote these offhand, but I think we've all read them in news publications from time to time, that rank American accomplishments on some basic skills like secondary school math accomplishment and things like that. And we know that we don't necessarily rank too well in those, maybe sort of in the middle and not as high as we clearly would like, as we'd like and we'd expect to be number one. So I guess I defer on the judgment of workplace skill. I defer to the sort of surveys and studies by others. In terms of workplace ethic and attitude, Americans can work just as hard and just as well as anybody else in the entire world. But also we find in lots of these emerging markets tremendous workplace attitudes and behaviors and energy levels. You know, I spent a lot of time in Asia, and lots of people in Asia run in the workplace. They actually physically run, and you can see it, and they are really tough on setting quality standards. They want to make it better, they want to make it perfect, and they want to make it better than perfect. And so I think the regrettable fact of all of this is that we have a very competitive workforce out there in the world, and we need to simply recognize that, set the high standard, and make sure that we perform ourselves at those levels.
China's trade imbalance with the United States is exploding. While it may be good business for United Technologies to get into China, what should U.S. policymakers do to stem the one-way flow of U.S. capital and jobs to a country with an authoritarian government?
Well, certainly there are aspects of the Chinese government's behavior that, as Americans, we don't agree with and we even find reprehensible, and there's a fair amount of commentary by our government about that, so I guess I won't add to that. I will express this opinion, though, that the history of the world's economies and societies and political mechanisms is fundamentally one of progress. I am an everlasting optimist, and I observe all the time that we see a few steps forward, we see a step back, a few more steps forward, a step back. Sometimes, as in the case of the former Soviet Union, it can be a 75-year step back. So it can be big and long. On the other hand, though, the net of all of this is progress over the long term. I believe that one of the most powerful ways, in fact, the most powerful way to bring societies and political systems more to our way of thinking is by the involvement of American business via foreign direct investment and via trade. I'll take the case of China in particular. Our company was in China as early as 1907. We got chucked in 1949. We went back in 1984. We went back pre-Tiananmen, and we dealt with and lived through the Tiananmen experience. We went back at a time when people sort of characterized capitalism as an odious and bad word, and I have seen employees of our companies, Chinese employees of our companies in China, go from being rabidly pro-communist to being rabidly pro-capitalist. And the reason why they made that change was because they looked at the improvements in efficiency, productivity, quality, motivation of the workforce, and they saw that the lives for their children would be better consequent on that political system. And the way you will cause China to change is by engagement and by involvement, by leadership and by example, not by flagellation and criticism. It's exactly like children. We give children room and opportunity to grow and to follow their parents by example. We don't expect them at age three to be perfect. We should do the same thing with foreign nations. That is to me, is the geopolitical case for engagement with foreign countries. It's the way we persuade by example that democratic market economy principles work and work very, very well. And that's why we should engage with China. Also, I'll go back to the principal line in the first half of this speech. America is going to transition to a knowledge society and to a very, very wealthy society. And it will do that in very large part by participating in the wealth creation in the rest of the world. And we will do that with engagement and involvement, not by Fortress America. The getting rich will happen in that part of the world with or without us. And we might as well participate and use the wealth creation there as a device to elevate the living standards of Americans.
The defense industry has been consolidating. Realizing this is only a piece of your company's business, you plan to make acquisitions in this field. Or, and someone else asked, maybe you want to sell off some units like Sikorsky and Pratt and Whitney, which don't appear, according to the questioner, to fit your philosophy very well.
Well, I do not believe, along with, I guess, Mr. Fukuyama, that we have come to the end of time. And I believe that armed conflict is going to be a fact of our lives forever into the future. And it may be that the armed conflict will take different forms and have different weapons and have different opponents and different situations. And I, for one, would be quick to defer to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Secretary of Defense and their staffs to decide what kind of weapons and how and so on and so forth. But I believe that armed conflict is in our future, and I believe that our company has been right smack at the core of that for the last 75 years, and we don't have any intention of not being right smack at the core of that. I'm reminded of the fact that Pratt and Whitney, that proud subsidiary of ours, supplied half of the propulsion for half the shaft horsepower for the entire Allied Air Forces in the Second World War, one half. And it seems to me that's a rather nice legacy and tradition and so forth, and so we don't have any intention of abandoning these businesses, and it might even be nice if we could make an acquisition or two or three, should that be convenient and suitable for all of the participants involved.
Your company does business in Japan. What's your opinion of Tokyo's sincerity in opening up to U.S. businessmen?
We've done business in Japan since 1891 when we sold exported equipment. In that case, it was elevators for the Bank of Japan, the Central Bank, in 1891, and we were incorporated there in 1931 with both Otis and Carrier. And we've had all of our companies do business in Japan since before the Second World War. I believe that Japan is slowly opening. I think that it is not as open as most other markets in the world. I don't think that there is some grand conspiracy on the part of the Japanese government and the Japanese industrial establishment to keep their markets closed at all. I think it's more simply a learned behavior on the part of Japanese industrial business people in particular. This is the so-called Keiretsu problem. Of course, a matter of choice, they'd rather deal with Japanese suppliers than they would with offshore suppliers. That's breaking down somewhat under the strength of the yen and the requirement to reduce costs of goods built in Japan. I think that we are perhaps a little bit too impatient with Japanese business people. Americans, as a race, I feel, a nation, we are all very impatient people. We want it right now. And I guess I've learned over my own now 25 years of very steady involvement in Japan. I go there 3-4 times a year, at least every year. We sell $1.5 billion a year into Japan. A bunch of it is, in fact, American exports. Engines and helicopters, and some of its local production with elevators and air conditioners. I guess I've come to learn the value of relationships. Eastern people venerate the tenure of relationships. They judge a relationship substantially, in large part, by how long it is. And, of course, that's just a good little lesson and tip to get started and be patient and wait a little while. I think all too often we want the quick buck in Japan, and we don't have the patience to develop the relationship. You also find that society is remarkably open at the consumer products level, and there are lots of American consumer trade names of great consequence and stature that are almost generics in Japan and have been for a very, very long time, and there's some new ones that are getting in there all the time. So I think the Japanese market is maybe more open than we might think, but it does take a certain amount of encouragement and persuasion because the Keiretsu issue is an issue. And I think the Japanese people, the ones I talked to about that, and I talked to lots of them, they recognize that and they work hard to offset that.
How has the North American Free Trade Agreement affected your business over the past year or so, and when do you expect the United States to see the true fruits of that accord?
Well, I think the North American Free Trade Agreement, like any free trade agreement, is a very, very good thing to have done, and certainly I would be an enthusiastic and strong supporter of that, and I had been and was at the time. I think, however, we have to remind ourselves that and the principal beneficiary of NAFTA was actually our neighbor to the south, Mexico, because the border with Canada has been for years substantially transparent in terms of flows of goods back and forth between ourselves and Canadians. We have to remember the fact that Mexico is actually a comparatively small economy. I guess on last computation, it's about the size of the economies of Connecticut and Massachusetts combined. And so while this is an important and good and beneficial thing to do, it's actually not going to move around the American economy, in my opinion, by all that much. And I guess if that's an answer to the great sucking sound, I don't mind that being an answer.
Thank you. Before we get to our famous final question, we have a couple of gifts for you. First, a certificate of appreciation for being with us. Secondly, a mug that you can fill with coffee to keep you awake on those long flights to Asia.
Thank you.
And the final question. You ready for this, right? How do your proposals be applied to the people in the news business? Do we need more education, or are we smart enough already?
You're all a bunch of geniuses and my best friends, and that's all I want to say in response to that. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. David, and I also want to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdo-Dermott, and Howard Rothman for organizing today's luncheon, and I thank all of you for coming. We are adjourned. Somebody sent up the outline of the question. I elaborated. Was it out there on the round? Just a minute, I'll find you.